After more than 2 years, Illinois has a full budget, but that's only the first step.
We didn't fall off the cliff, but we're still hanging. We're not going to go back and everything's rosy now. These are going to be very tough times.
With a backlog of billions of dollars in bills, Illinois faces a long road to recovery for social services, healthcare, education, and many more. What's next for Illinois? Plus, one of the reasons Illinois' budget standoff became the longest since the Great Depression, most people said it didn't really matter to them. We'll talk about why. And for more than 100 years, Sears has meant something special to many people in Illinois.
Sears offered Americans the opportunity to realize the dream of the middle class in an affordable way. And beyond that, Sears was a good place to work.
They've also been losing billions of dollars and will be closing 43 more stores across the country. Retirees in Illinois join us to talk about what Sears meant to them. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. It took 2 years and the override of the governor's vetoes to finally pass a full state budget for Illinois. And as current and former lawmakers told us last week, that's only the first step. So what's next? How does the state start to rebuild and repair, especially for social services providers, universities and schools, hospitals, others who rely on at least some money from the state? That's what we're going to be focused on today. But before we look ahead, let's revisit what 736 days with no budget sounded like through the words of just some of the people we talked with on the 21st, starting with Superintendent Dan Cox and NEIU student Yadira Alonzo.
School's ready to start in August. We're planning, and we don't know how to even plan for a budget or plan for what type of revenues we're going to have.
Last semester, our classes were canceled due to the cuttings, and we did not have a place to study for finals because Springfield can't get it together.
Over the course of a day in this country, there's almost 29,000 people a day that are abused by someone they know, love, and trust. We have been a longtime service partner with the state of Illinois. Our concern about the state budget crisis grows daily.
Well, you go home and cry a lot, and then you basically kind of pray that nobody's going to die, because people do. You try to do the best that you can with the resources you have.
We need a budget, period, end of discussion. This is literally killing people every day.
A look back there on the past 2 years without a state budget. Those voices included Carol Myrna of the Center for Prevention of Abuse in Peoria and two people who are back with us now on the phone. Linda Bookwalter, Executive Director of Stopping Woman Abuse Now. They're based in Olney, serving counties across southern Illinois. Also Sarah Howe, the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health, which represents more than 60 service providers. Linda, Sarah, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having
Thanks for having us.
And Linda, let's start with you. I mean, we've talked before on the show about, you know, the fact that domestic violence agencies were particularly hard hit these past 2 years, not only no budget like other groups, but groups like the ones you work with were also largely left out of the stopgap spending bill. So how close were you to not being able to keep your doors open?
We were extremely close. We had anticipated that we would close by May 31st, but we kind of had an influx of people coming in, so we decided we had tried for 2 more weeks, and then we gave people deadlines that they had to be out in 2 weeks. And then we would tell people that, you know, unless we got some kind of money from one of the other grants that we had, then we probably were going to close. And so we started doing that in May and did that clear up into July. And we had planned on closing by July 9th, and we just were doing 2 weeks at a time. And whenever people called, we would say, you know, you need to know that you can only stay this long.
So had there not been a budget, you would have closed your doors yesterday.
Probably. In all likelihood, yes, we would have.
So when you did then see that budget passed, then as the director of the organization there, I mean, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I was just floored. I mean, I kind of knew that the governor probably wouldn't pass anything, and I knew that it would probably finally end up with a veto override. But it's just been extremely stressful through this whole process, and it didn't seem like no matter what we did, it wasn't making a difference, and people in the legislators nor the governor were getting it. It was extremely difficult for our staff, because I had already told people who were being laid off, so I'm getting ready to call some people back. You face the issue of they know that they're expendable and do they want to come back. Some of them I know are not coming back. and some of them had a real hardship by having to go on furlough days. I have quite a few people that are the only support in their family, or they're single parents with children, and it's just been stressful for everyone, and it makes it just very difficult because you can't say much. You don't have any answers.
Yeah, there's no information. Yeah.
At least if we would have had a budget, even if they were going to cut us, I mean, not that I wanted to be cut, at least I knew what I had to work with. This way, there was just, you didn't know. And with being left out in that stopgap budget, that was a real hardship on us in terms of money. It was a hardship for clients because you would hear, well, what am I supposed to do? I don't have any place else to go. You mean I can only stay 2 weeks? What am I going to do? I'll have to go back to my abuser. So it's been a real challenge and just extremely stressful on everybody.
Yeah, and so now you're looking at kind of how to rebuild the service, the capacity, and then bring people back in to seek out those services. Sarah, just to bring you into the conversation, many of the mental health, addiction, other groups that we've talked to over the past few years have also faced some of these tough questions. Some have had to close themselves. So where's your focus now as you work with your member organizations?
Well, it's very similar to what Linda was talking about, which is rebuilding a system that was already underfunded before we started this fiscal crisis and now has been eroded significantly. The capacity for services is way down. We have had providers close, and as I've told people over the past few days, they're not reopening today because there is a budget. They're not just coming back on the scene. And
it's not a magic fix.
It's not a magic fix. We have very similar issues that Linda talked about. People don't want to come back to work if they're working with the state, particularly if they're not sure they're going to keep their job. They're going to go look for something where they believe it's more stable, whether that's working in a totally different industry, whether it's working in another state, or if it's just saying, are you state funded or are you, private insurance? Okay, I'll come work for you if it's private insurance. So that's a challenge. What we know as of last March, so I'm talking March 2016, we had lost 1,000 direct care workers as of that date and time. We're going to go back and actually resurvey and see where we are. We know it's more than that. And that doesn't include administrative caseworkers. This is just direct staff clinicians that do addiction and mental health work.
And this is a field that can be difficult to recruit into as is, and now adding this on top of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this isn't a high-paying field. You're certainly working with clients that are in the midst of probably some of their most challenging times. And the people that do this work, they really care about these clients and really help them get on their feet, get on a path to recovery. But it's difficult work, and nobody's getting rich off of it. So it is, recruitment-wise, it's a challenging thing. And then when you say, well, we're not quite sure, if we're going to make payroll this week, that's challenging regardless of what you're doing.
Yeah, no matter how inspiring the work might be.
Particularly in this arena.
Linda, Sarah just mentioned sort of that it's not an instant fix. The money doesn't start flowing today. Do you know when you've received any word on when payments will start to come from the state?
No, we have not. And it is just exactly what she says. There isn't an instant fix. And you hope money starts flowing quickly. But, like us, if we have to want to go ahead and borrow money, that means we have to pay interest. That's additional money we have to come up with because of we have to repay the interest, and interest is not allowed on any state or federal grant. I mean, I have a lot of people that have just gone to places that are, like she says, private pay. And with, mental health services being affected, that even hinders our programming, because then when people come into your program, whether they're homeless or domestic violence victims, and they need those services, they're not there. And so it's very difficult to deal with some issues of domestic violence when you can't get them stabilized, whether they're on, meth or alcohol or something like that. If you can't get those issues stabilized, then you can't even begin to address some of the other issues. So it makes it difficult because your resources for them are very limited now. It's just difficult, but it is not just because they have a budget. It's not instantaneous that tomorrow, next week, I'm going to get money.
So Sarah, it's a lot of, sort of triage, a lot of playing catch up with a lot of these services and people who sort of fell through the cracks in the last couple of years. You know, what's it going to take, do you think, to bring back, you're talking staffing, bring people back in for services, to rebuild the state's ability to serve people like they were doing before?
Well, I think the first thing is what Linda talks about, is getting some of those dollars flowing. I mean, that's going to be the first thing. And that's not going to happen overnight. But we hope as we get a budget in place and the departments start to figure out what's in the line items and how they can get those dollars out the door, that's going to be the first thing, is our providers need to be able to just get back on a steady payment schedule where they're comfortable being able to rehire some individuals, being able to reopen some programs. For example, one of the things that we've lost across the state is detox services. We have very few state-funded detox services right now. They are very sporadic in terms of the areas where you find them in the state. And we've lost those over the course of probably the last 5 or 6 years, but it's really accelerated under this budget impasse for the last 2 years. Before a provider is going to say, hey, this makes sense, let's reopen detox, they're going to see what happens in terms of the dollars. Are they flowing? What happens in terms of, you know, is the state going to spend the money that's in all those line items? There's still quite a few unknowns. Once we get a little bit down the road and we see what happens, then they can really start strategically planning what's next, what service can we reopen, how can we promote this to a community? Because the last thing you want to do is say, we're going to reopen this service, and then a month or two later or 6 months later, well, we actually found that we can't because the dollars aren't coming in as quickly as we'd like. So it's going to take some time, but we've eroded the system over a course of several years. We accelerated that erosion, particularly the entire social services fabric. As Linda talks about, it's all interwoven. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take time to build it back up. This didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to get fixed overnight. But having a budget was critical to getting us started. And I think that's the really critical piece here, is this is much better than no budget at all. So you've got to start somewhere, and we're taking those baby steps to get there.
All right, so it's the beginning of a long process. Linda Bookwalter, Executive Director of Stopping Woman Abuse Now, based in Olney. And you just heard there Sarah Howe, CEO of Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. Thank you both very much, and good luck here in the weeks and the months and years ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And many of those themes also playing out across the campuses of state colleges and universities in the state. And many of them took a hit during the budget crisis. Chicago State, Northeastern, other campuses had to lay people off, shorten schedules to save money. Illinois State University fared better than most, but still had to cut costs, rely on reserves to get through. Larry Dietz is a president of Illinois State, joins us now by phone. President Dietz, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. No, you know, I know ISU and the University of Illinois managed to avoid things like layoffs, but you had to leave hundreds of positions between the two of them unfilled, delaying projects, getting kind of creative with some funding sources. You know, what, now that there is a budget, what is your top priority on campus there?
Well, I think the highest priority, now that we know a dollar amount, that was the critical piece for us. And now that we know a dollar amount, we have plans that have been in place for a long period of time that are scalable. And so we're not going to, go out and celebrate wildly by any stretch, but we still have a $9 million cut that we've got to absorb for this fiscal year. And so we're going to be about, scaling our planning process to incorporate that $9 million cut. But I was listening in to the other colleagues in social services, and we have felt their pain, and good government and good states have strong social services and strong educational programs. And so our sense is not a lot different than theirs, and that it is simply that we have a budget. It has proven that people can come together and make decisions collaboratively. People can disagree, but having the budget is a huge step in the right direction, and that it, to me, should be giving people more confidence that there is some stability, at least for this year and hopefully for years after this.
So it's similar when I'm hearing that theme of, some relief, but certainly not celebration. I know you also convened the statewide group of university presidents and chancellors. I don't know if that group's had a chance to meet since the budget, on Thursday, but what are you hearing from other schools, the other presidents and chancellors you talked to, about what, what's next for them? I'm especially thinking about campuses that were hit hard, that were forced to lay people off, seeing enrollment declines, right, things like that.
Well, we have a conference call typically every week, and we had one before the vote. And people were optimistic that that everything would pass the way it did, but I've not talked with them. I will on Wednesday is our scheduled conference call, and so I'll talk with them again on Wednesday. I do know that we're all pretty much in the same boat, and that is we've still had cuts. We have a budget now, but now we know the dollar amount, and we're still going to have to absorb that. So there may be some additional considerations on all the campuses about how they're going to absorb their own individual cuts for the current year. But I think they would echo the idea that at least there is a budget, and there should be some confidence among the elected officials that they really can come together and get something done. I know there's a great consternation and a lot of disagreement about whether or not what's the right thing to get done, but the right thing is to have a budget. And does this one cure all ills? No, but it should send a message to the public that there is some stability for this current year, and hopefully there will be for the year after that and the year after that. Having no budget for a couple of years has been absolutely devastating. So now we've crested the hill, and the future looks a bit brighter.
And, President Deese, we've only got here about 30 more seconds, but just real quick, you talked about sort of having that confidence and that stability. Looking ahead, looking into an election year in 2018 and what's to come and another budget deal that'll have to be made before the next fiscal year, are you confident that we won't be in this position again in a year from now?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm an optimist, and I'm hopeful that that will happen. But, the people that that are elected to represent us, they have voted what they thought was the best vote, and that's really going to be, those votes past and future will really be the vote of their conscience and their constituents. And so we're just glad that they came together this time. Hope it'll happen again.
All right. Well, President Larry Dietz, Illinois State University, thank you very much for the time. Good luck to you. And we will continue this conversation when we come back in just a moment. This is The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here. With a few days now to let the news settle that Illinois has its first full budget in more than 2 years, today we're looking ahead. What's next, and how does the state begin to rebuild and repair the damage? On Friday, we talked with a spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. The state owes its members roughly $8 billion for medical services provided by both Medicaid patients and state employees. That bill backlog has been particularly tough for rural hospitals. Randy Dobie is the CEO of Pinckneyville Community Hospital District. It's about 30 miles north of Carbondale. Randy, welcome back to the 21st.
Oh, good to be here.
Now, we've talked early this hour about the widespread effects, on the ability to serve people across the state. I'd like to ask you specifically about that money owed to hospitals for Medicaid, for state employees. How has that affected your ability to serve people, particularly in rural areas of southern Illinois?
Well, it makes it difficult on a cash flow basis. We have to pay our bills, and our vendors expect to be paid. But when you're not getting paid from the state, it makes cash pretty tight at times. So we really have to watch the bills we are paying and the dollars coming in to make sure that there's enough to pay our bills. And that makes it difficult, especially the rural hospitals, because we have narrow margins, and many of the hospitals operate in a negative margin. So it really makes it difficult. So this payment for the budget is going to help us substantially be able to bring the funds in to help pay our bills.
And have we seen, we've heard in the past about some places that had to close certain services or not provide certain services or temporarily reduce services. How has that affected you?
We've been able to hold on and not have to shut down any services, but if this continued on, we really have to look at those aspects of that and what services are we really tight on. We do a lot of free services for our community, and we don't expect any reimbursement. But at some point, you have to look at those services and say, if we're not going to get any money for the state, we can't even pay for the services we got, so we're going to have to start
you know, stop some of the services that are free to this community because you just can't afford, you got to find ways to cut costs, and that's the ideal place to do it, which hurts the community, hurts the services you provide to the community on a free basis.
And that's similar to what we heard earlier from some of the other, you know, domestic violence providers and behavioral health providers and things like that. And I guess I'll ask you a similar question. We heard them talk about having to rebuild, to refocus some of their energies, you know, still some uncertainty about when money would start to actually flow. Where is your focus now for your organization now that a budget is in place?
Our focus is, you know, we don't know for sure when the money is going to come in. So they said somewhere between now and the end of the year before they get the borrowing and done. And so it still may be some time before we see that reimbursement come through. You know, we're operating on a 6 to 8 month basis anyway to before we get any reimbursement. And, of course, the state of Illinois, we haven't seen any reimbursement for employees for the last 2 years. So now that the budget is in place, you know, our focus is hopefully we can collect that money. We'll continue providing the services to state employees. We haven't turned anybody away, and we'll continue to do that. But our goal is to keep providing more services to the community, making sure people are hearing about wellness and keeping people healthy versus, you know, always treating the sick. And that's the focus of where healthcare is going, and we want to deliver that. But you cannot deliver that if you don't have the funds coming in on a regular basis.
Randy Doby, CEO of Pickneyville Community Hospital, the district that's about 30 miles north of Carbondale, serving communities throughout southern Illinois. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time today.
Okay.
And I should point out, too, that as employees of the University of Illinois, we are, full disclosure, among the group of state employees that he was referring to there. You know, we've talked so far here about some of the people most affected by the budget crisis, what some have called a slow-motion, man-made disaster. But the fact is, most Illinois residents say they have not felt the pain directly. A poll from as recently as March said that two-thirds of Illinoisans didn't feel that the budget crisis affected them, which likely played a role in extending the political standoff. So what is the role of public opinion in all of this? Brian Mackey is a State House reporter with Illinois Public Radio, and from Carbondale, Jack Tichenor is interim director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University, and of course, host of Illinois Lawmakers on public television. Brian, Jack, welcome back to the 21st.
It's good to be here.
Good to talk to you.
And Brian's our first post-budget conversation here, I guess. You know, you've been covering politics for a long time, this budget crisis from beginning to end. You know, I'm thinking back here to one of the people you talked to last week. There's a retiree in Springfield who said he hasn't been affected by all this and actually said, quote, I figured they'll get it together sometime. Is that, have you found, fairly typical among the people who you talk to across the state about this?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not doing those sorts of Vox Populi stories all that often, but you do run into people who are outside our circle of people who are very invested in government, as most of the people in the state house are. And yeah, a lot of them just kind of shake their heads. They've been treated to decades, at least a decade, of headlines about how messed up Illinois government is, and certainly the former governors Rod Blagojevich and George Ryan going to prison don't help that image. So a lot of people just sort of assume that Illinois government should be in a bad shape. And sometimes when they hear that, well, we don't have a budget, they just kind of shake their heads and think, well, just another bad headline about government, and maybe don't realize how different and unusual and outside the norms, even by Illinois standards, the last 2 years have been.
Yeah, by Illinois standards, or that reputation. Jack, I mean, the numbers that we were talking about, that poll from March, came from your organization, the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute there at SIU. And again, it said that two-thirds of Illinoisans didn't feel that the budget crisis affected them. How did most people say they felt insulated from this, even as many others across the state were hit so hard?
Well, it's good you ask. We asked them, have you or has someone in your family, immediate family, been affected by the budget stalemate? 33% said it had affected them, but as you pointed out, 62% actually responded it had not. Of those who were impacted by the budget crisis, the largest groups of respondents argued that it had resulted in K-12 funding cuts, job losses, and cuts to needed social services. And we also asked about if families living in poverty were more or less affected by the impasse. Over half, 56%, said families in poverty had been more impacted, with around 22% saying families in poverty had been impacted less. So it kind of goes back to what the person Brian had been talking to kind of indicated, that for the most part, this has been taking place off the radar screen for most Illinoisans, because you could go down to the local driver's license office, get your license renewed, state prison stayed open, school stayed open, and universities were open, although they were certainly hurting for the most part. It basically was happening below the radar.
Below the radar. So you, that, and, mm-hmm. Brian, I hear you trying to jump in here, but just the, and maybe Brian, you can answer this question. How does that translate then into a lack of political pressure, into a lack of action on a budget over 2 years?
Well, I mean, and I would like to point out that in fact, by people saying that they thought elementary and secondary schools were affected by the budget impasse, it just goes to show how little people are actually understanding or following what was happening, because that was the one area of state government that was consistently funded during the impasse. So how it contributed is that there just wasn't this sort of public pressure to get a budget done from the mass public. We saw in, I think it's a great sort of natural experiment we had in the last couple of weeks. Remember the headlines coming out of New Jersey, where the state parks closed over the 4th of July holiday, and there was Governor Christie on the beach with his family. That got national attention. Illinois has had a sort of government shutdown in some areas of government. The programs that help senior citizens or people with disabilities, they have really been struggling for the past 2 years. But that has not sort of generated the immediately recognizable, outrage-generating sort of imagery of the governor and his family on a beach that's closed to the public over a holiday weekend. Yeah. And as Jack said, you can get your driver's license renewed, and that sort of thing contributed to this lack of popular outrage, I think.
And one highly respected reporter we've talked to referred to as a stealth government shutdown. I think Brian Mackey said that in the past. Jack, coming back to you, I mean, the polling was also interesting in having people take a look at how to address some of the state's issues, particularly the budget shortfall. You know, and there seemed to be a recognition that, yes, there was a problem, that there was a spending and a revenue issue there, that they just were not matching up. But there was almost, well, I'll let you give the numbers, there was almost complete denial of how to actually approach that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I went back after we knew we were going to be talking about this. In 2008, when we first started doing the Simon poll, 4 out of 5 respondents said government overspending was the problem, so you could cut your way out of it. Well, when we looked at it in March, basically 45% said cutting waste and inefficiency was the way to handle it. But what we saw was there was a growing recognition that just cuts alone wouldn't do it. When you looked at people who favored the 11% who favored an income tax, and you add that to the 35% who thought that budget cuts and income would be needed, or some sort of revenue enhancement would be needed, it comes up to 46%, just the opposite. 45% said that cutting spending would get you there. 46% basically said it was going to take a combination of new revenue and budget cuts. So it was dawning on people that there wasn't all this governmental bloat out there, that government was actually needing more revenues to keep operating. So we saw that over the period that we've been doing this. What was interesting, though, when you get down to it and ask about, specific areas.
Yeah, where would you cut?
Well, we asked them that. In the case of K-12, 82% said don't cut it. When you go through higher education, they said don't cut it. When it's parks and recreation, don't cut it. They basically didn't want anything cut. Same thing for programs for the poor like Medicaid. And at the end of the day, you know, it's like the old saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And that has been one of the consistent showings of the poll ever since the very first days back in 2008. People basically liked the state services they were getting. They just didn't want to pay for them.
So, I mean, Jack, and obviously the politicians are watching this, their staffs are watching this. People are keeping an eye for that question of who really is to blame here. And in this case, it turned out that there was no consensus at all around that. But, you know, I mean, is there a type of public pressure in a different sort of situation, a different environment? You know, I mentioned New Jersey before. What kind of public pressure do you think would have helped solve this impasse sooner?
if there had actually been something other than a stealth shutdown, if you'd been in the same situation as New Jersey and people couldn't go to the beach, I'm not saying that Governor Rauner would have been at the beach or anything like that, but if you had something like that where people couldn't go to the park, they couldn't get their driver's license renewed or their license tag renewed, and they were facing a big fine if they got pulled over with out-of-date tags, I think there would have been an outrage there. But as it happened, the areas where the pressure was being felt were kind of isolated, mainly around the university campuses, what we call the directional universities, northern, western, eastern, southern. But that, at the end of the day, when you look at the number of House Republicans and the one Senate Republican who broke with Governor Rauner and the caucus leaders on that, that pressure was starting to build. In the case of Terry Bryant from Murfreesboro, whose district SIU Carbondale sits right in the middle of, she had not only SIU, she heard from people who worked at the prisons. She's a former corrections person herself. We have three state Department of Transportation garages here. We have mental health facilities here. So the impact was magnified in those areas. And that's, I think at the end of the day, that's what tipped the balance when you saw lawmakers actually vote their districts.
And Brian, I mean, coming back to you, is that, you know, because lawmakers did finally pass that budget last week. They had to override a veto from the governor to do it, or vetoes from the governor to do it. But, I mean, does that sound about right? Is that what finally kind of moved the needle?
I mean, that's what the Republicans who crossed the aisle said. We heard Representative Steve Anderson say earlier this summer, I guess it was in the late spring at the end of the main, the typical legislative session in May, the scheduled session. He said, you know, at this point, you have to wonder how much reform we could possibly get for the damage that we've inflicted on Illinois. And, you know, the people who want to improve the business climate here, I think they're sincere in their belief there. You know, they talk about changing the cost of workers' compensation, trying to bring manufacturing jobs to Illinois by doing things like that. But what often gets overlooked is that these social service providers, they're employers as well, and a lot of them have had to lay off people. And same thing with universities. We've seen hundreds of people laid off from universities like Southern, Eastern, Western, Chicago State, Northeastern Illinois University. So it does seem like, you know, that was the thing, and you needed some Republicans to cross the aisle to make this bipartisan from the Democratic point of view. And so that's what they all cited. You know, they said, you know, State Representative David Harris from the suburbs said, you know, I did not get elected to preside over the destruction of Illinois.
Right. You know, and Brian, I mean, looking ahead a little bit here, we only got a couple of minutes left here, but a big part of what solved this was that income tax hike, you know, two tax hikes, but income tax going from 3.75 up to 4.95%. 2018, an election year, obviously we're already hearing about all this through the ads for the governor race. How do you think voters will react to all of this?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, voters typically, as we heard, don't like the idea of the tax increase, and the governor has essentially an infinite amount of money to spend on advertising, driving home. I mean, it's a 1.2 percentage point tax increase from 3.75% to 4.95%, but you're going to hear it characterized by the governor and his allies as a 32% tax increase, which just sounds a lot worse, mm-hmm. even though mathematically it's the same thing, because you're dealing with very small numbers here. What I wonder, there's something in that poll, the Simon poll from earlier this year, that doesn't get talked about as much. I didn't bring it up when I was tweeting about this stuff last week, is that there is a lot of support in Illinois for a graduated income tax. And so it seems like there's an opportunity for a Democrat there if they wanted to, you know, try and change the tax discussion from just, you know, good versus bad to like, how are we taxing? And, you know, is it fair that the minimum wage worker is, you know, paying the same flat tax rate as, for example, the governor or a physician or a lawyer or anyone else.
And we see that model in other in surrounding states even, you know,
throughout
the Midwest and the country.
Yeah, most states have that, actually. And you look at that, we asked about applying a 3% excise tax on income above of over $1 million a year. That was 78% approved of that, and the graduated income tax, 72% supported that.
Well, so there's the data on that. Brian Mackey, State House reporter, Illinois Public Radio, Jack Tichner, Interim Director, Paul Simon, Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. Lots more here to talk about. I'm sure we'll be in touch here in the coming weeks and months, but thank you both very much for joining us today.
Good to talk to you.
You're very welcome.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
And you're listening to The 21st.
There's more for your life. Here's Cooler Gun, Muzzler 2, VCRs and big screen view.
There's more for your life.
But there's
in store for you.
Wilson styles for having fun. Free spirit bikes for everyone.
There's more for your life.
In store for your life.
There's more for your life.
More for your life.
More for your life. At
the retail giant Sears was born more than a century ago, and the company quickly became the place where America shops, as the slogan went. One analyst even credited the Illinois-based retailer with democratizing retail in the country. A lot has changed since then. Earlier this year, the parent company warned that, quote, substantial doubt exists about the company's ability to survive. Hundreds of stores are closing or closed, and just last week, Sears announced 43 more stores will close across the country, including one in Peru, Illinois. It's about 60 miles north of Peoria. Many Illinois residents had long careers at Sears and saw this all play out up close. Those include Ron Olbrich, chairman of the National Association of Retired Sears Employees, based in Chicago. Also, Dick Bruce and Bill Barker, members of that association. They join us now here by phone. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for talking to us.
It's good to be with you today.
Well, hi. Thank you for the opportunity to be on the show.
No, of course. I mean, let's start with you. I mean, take us back to, 1972. You first began working at Sears sort of right after the heyday of the store in some ways and leading into some of its better years. You know, what was it like to work for Sears back then?
Well, first of all, it was a great company to work for. When I joined the company, it was the number one retailer in the country, if not the world. The salary was good. I was able to put four kids through college, great benefits. We had discounts on merchandise. We had profit sharing, paid up life insurance, medical insurance, et cetera. And when I started with Sears, I started as a trademark attorney. And through the years, I handled advertising review, investigations, customer complaints, et cetera. And my last 12 years with the company was as assistant general counsel in the marketing practices section of the law department.
So, and I understand that you were sort of faced a choice. You know, you're looking at a couple of different jobs. That General Electric, I think, was one you were looking at. But how did you ultimately decide? What brought you to Sears?
Well, what brought me to Sears, as I said before, were the great benefits, and the company had a phenomenal reputation. And of course, that was back in 1972. Things started changing as we went on. In fact, when I joined Sears, it was known as the big store. Unfortunately, today, it's really now the shrinking store.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Dick, coming to you here for a minute, you know, what made you leave a management job? Now, I understand you were a training job at Ford to come to Sears. This is back in 1960. What brought you to Sears?
Well, actually, the time at Ford, and I had a love affair with automobiles, so I went to work for them, had great salary benefits and a good career ahead of me, but it was rather narrow, and I really thought that I could get myself into a better position career-wise with a company like Sears, as Ron pointed out. When I went to work for them in 60, it was the country's largest employer, was the fourth or fifth biggest revenue producer, and was a significant percentage of the country's gross national product. And books such as Merchant to the Millions and The Big Store were written about Sears. And the benefits, of course, were unparalleled in terms of what people were able to look forward to. And then the fact that Sears expanded internationally and our expertise was being sought by other countries, major retailers such as Walton's in Australia and Cebu Seyu in Japan and such as that. And, of course, you know, I could go on and on about what has happened since that time. But
yeah.
The point of going to work for Sears, I like the idea of the varied opportunities that were available career-wise, a lot of diversity.
Well, and I'm hearing, too, you know, that you're talking about the benefits and the pay and things. I'm also hearing, as you describe Sears and what it meant to work there, that there was a prestige there, that, you know, now while there may be certain prestige to work in, you know, a high-tech sector or certain industries like that, that at that moment, Sears was kind of the place to be. Bill, was that your experience?
Well, mine is quite different. I came to Sears after I had immigrated from Scotland, and I was in the British Merchant Navy and had gone through the maritime school and was a officer cadet and finished my seagoing career as a fourth officer on a British shipping company. Met my wife in New York in 56 and they left the sea in 58. And I came ashore considered an alien, which I take exception to since I was from the UK, but no, that's another story, and just had to find a job. At that time, I was still young enough to be 1A, and everywhere I went, come back when you finished your military service. Well, I already been there during the Korean War, but because I was from the UK, that didn't count. So I got a job with Sears just to find a job near where I lived.
Nice, and that sort of became... Oh, go ahead.
And I'd heard of Sears as a good stock back in the UK, but at that time I wasn't too much interested in the financial aspects. So I came to Sears as a plumbing heating salesman, actually indoors, so it was a salary plus 1%, barely livable salary. And the store manager there kind of clicked on, and he mentored me, and I got to realize that I could retire at 55, although that seemed a long way off, with profit sharing, and saw some opportunities. Plus, I was mentored, eventually became his assistant in a small store in Jamaica, New York.
Ah, so it became a place that really sort of introduced you and helped you get settled in the country.
Yes, I had a mentor, so to speak. Realized where I'd been, and that was it.
Well, Ron, coming back to you, I mean, when you all get together now as part of the association, I mean, what do you talk about? Do you reminisce sort of the good old days? Do you talk about what's going on now? How do those conversations go?
Well, sure. We certainly reminisce. We have monthly meetings. And with our monthly meetings, we also have a toll-free conference call where we have retirees across the country join us to talk about what's happening with the company, the latest news about the company. And unfortunately, most of it has been negative, as you know.
Lately, yeah.
You mentioned at the very beginning what Sears said several months ago when they said, you know, substantial doubt exists relating to the company's ability to continue as a going concern. And looking back on my days with the company, I think that the company has made some major missteps. First thing, they failed to recognize Walmart, and that was a major error on their part.
Just recognize the level of competition that was coming from that model?
Oh, definitely. In fact, as an example, Walmart, I believe, was formed back in 1962, and it wasn't even on the Sears radar screen as a competitor. In 1980, Walmart had just passed $1 billion in revenues, and then in 1990, it passed Sears with $32 billion in revenues, and that was from a company that Sears at first failed to take seriously. And then, even more importantly, in the 90s, Amazon came on the scene, and Sears just completely ignored the digital revolution. They're trying to catch up now, but that was a problem.
You know, and all of you mentioned the salary in the sorry, is that Dick?
I'm sorry. Yes, this is Dick.
Go ahead.
I wanted to do a little addendum there on the Amazon thing. You know, Sears made the mistake about not considering Walmart competition. They also, I think, made a grievous error in exiting the catalog with all of the countrywide distribution facilities that Sears had. And they had the opportunity, I think, well in advance of Amazon to be the equivalent of or even more so than what the Amazon has become.
They had the infrastructure, you're saying, there to own that space without having to build out like Amazon did?
Yeah, and the facilities were all there. The expertise was there. You know, when you look at a company that has started Discover Card, Prodigy, Allstate, had picked up Dean Witter, which became Morgan Stanley, and Coldwell Banker. I mean, Sears was always on the rather leading edge and in advance of everything. And that doesn't mean that just because they fell on hard times, they no longer had the resources and talent to go ahead and have quite a large presence in that what you call the tech market, for instance.
Yeah.
And but you know, mistakes were made.
Well, you know, and Dick, I mean, as I hear you talking, all of you really, I mean, you know, Bill and Ron, it's you can hear in your voices. This is not just a company that's having trouble here. I mean, I get the sense that you're describing a loss of something bigger than, you know, any one particular company. Is that your sense?
Yes. Can I?
I would certainly agree.
This is Bill.
Yeah, Bill, go ahead.
I was a store runner, if you understand the term.
No, so what is that? Can you describe that to people who don't know?
A store runner was, I started as a salesman, went up through the ranks in the store, eventually became assistant store manager. In a couple of cases, I was a store manager, but leaning back from another job in the operating areas of a store. But in the early 1960s, me and my peers, who at that time were mostly assistant store managers or operating superintendents of large stores, we saw the discounters coming in. And we talked quite a bit about we were trying to go upscale, and the discounters were stealing our popcorn and eroding our market. It was brought up before. We saw ourselves as merchants to the millions, not to the elitist. But it seemed our then senior management was trying to go upscale and not paying much attention to the change in the marketplace. And this intensified more in the 70s and later, when some of us thought we should be having what was, and there was a prototype, I believe, S-Mart, smart stores. And that was dropped because that was not Sears, according to the powers to be. That would be the officer corps and the board. So I saw that forming as a store runner. And eventually, of course, I became operating manager for regions and the whole northern part of the country. But even during that, it was hard to get away from the mentality of that's not Sears. We did this and we did that, and then discounting. The customers don't expect that from us. Central cashiers. Eventually, we had to go to central cashiers. But even there, we missed the boat.
Yeah, so lots of missed opportunities here that all three of you are describing over the years.
So
I mean,
love
yeah,
the
but
store,
you know,
the store
could
for
I
real
just interject
family.
For a minute? This
real
this,
quick, Ron. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Because you talked about nostalgia and reminiscing and everything. And when I reflect back on my career with Sears, it was like having the opportunity to work for many different countries because of the many different career changes that I was able to enjoy. I got to travel the country and also many different countries because I spent time in the international operation. And one of the things that we always talk about are some of the things that I particularly missed at interacting with many of the key people in the organization, as well as those in other companies. And Sears was very generous in terms of education, whether it's sending me to the Harry Levinston Institute, teaching me Spanish for the international operations. It was basically a very, very not only good, but provided many experiences that I doubt I would have enjoyed with any other company.
Yeah, otherwise. And that's Dick Bruce, Sears retiree. I'm sorry, I think I called you Ron before. Mm-hmm. But Ron, coming back to you just for a minute, we've only got a couple of minutes here left, unfortunately, but what are your shopping habits like this? Do you still go to Sears? Are you a Sears shopper after all these years?
Well, probably like most other people now, I do my shopping primarily online. And as I said, it has had a great impact upon all the brick-and-mortar stores, not only Sears. As you know, Macy's is closing stores, JCPenney, Nordstrom, Kohl's, etc. And I think more and more people are shopping online rather than going to an actual store. And that's the result of the changing in the shopping habits of customers, primarily due to online buying. And as a result of that, all these brick-and-mortar stores have suffered lost revenues, and they've closed, you know, many of their stores. So to answer your question, no, I don't shop at Sears that much anymore.
Yeah, which is fairly representative, I suppose, of many others. We've only got 30 seconds left here, but one more question, I suppose. Dick, let me ask you this just as a last point. You know, where are
sure,
you now
okay.
in terms of Sears and looking ahead? And, you know, are they going to make it? What are your feelings right now?
Okay, my opinion is that, yes, they are going to make it. They're going to be a much smaller company. The three of us that are on the phone had the opportunity to meet with some of the key management currently in place at Sears. We're very impressed with them and the direction they're taking the company. So I'm encouraged. Even though it's not going to be the glory days that we all experienced, it looks like it's going to be. They're making some good moves.
All right. Well, that's Dick Bruce. We also talked with Bill Barker, Ron Ulbrich, all retirees from Sears. Ron, also the chairman of the National Association of Retired Sears Employees based in Chicago. Thank you very much. I appreciate the sort of the inside look at what's been going on and a look back at sort of what Sears meant to Illinois and the country. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time that we have here for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can find all those links and directions for Alexa, too. Every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.